The G word, gentrification, is a hot-button term that describes what happens when city neighborhoods undergo renewal and renovation, followed by an influx of middle-class or affluent people, displacing the poorer residents who've lived there as owners or renters for years. In this hour, we hear from writer D. Watkins, who in a recent essay said his native Baltimore had become unrecognizable, overrun with yuppies pushing out black residents. Community architect Klaus Philipson offers a different view, pointing out that most redevelopment has taken place along or near the waterfront and central corridors, not in African-American neighborhoods. Is gentrification a thing in Baltimore? And if so, where? And if so, is that a problem? First, the news. And welcome to our second hour of Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. In this hour, a conversation about the G word, G for gentrification. The word means different things to different people. Traditionally, the word has referred to redevelopment that occurs in a low-income neighborhood, leading to higher property values that force out the area's original residents. Over time, the term gentrification has become increasingly entangled with issues of race, class, cultural division in the ongoing debate over the future of cities where residents are displaced. That point of view was outlined in a report by the Brookings Institution some time ago. The report called gentrification, quote, a politically loaded concept that generally has not been useful in resolving growth and community change debates because its meaning is unclear. The Washington Post's Wonk blog called gentrification, quote, the most loaded, least understood word in urban renewal. Last month, Governing Magazine released a report on gentrification in certain U.S. cities, including Baltimore. They used data from the U.S. Census Bureau to map changes in those areas. Here in Baltimore, the magazine reported showed gentrification has been going on for decades. Much of that change is centered on the city's waterfront, such as in Locust Point, Federal Hill, Canton, now Harbor East. Other areas such as Remington, Woodbury, and Hamden have followed. Some would say you can trace the gentrification back to the redevelopment of Federal Hill in the 1970s under the Dollar House program operated by the city during the Schaefer administration. Census data shows that the transformation of these communities over the years is by and large what you would expect, mostly white. Once blue-collar neighborhoods such as Hamden, Remington, Fells Point, and Federal Hill make up most of the neighborhoods that have been gentrified. Other neighborhoods that some say are targeted for further gentrification include Middle East, Poppleton, Reservoir Hill, and the Hollins Market Pigtown area. Joining me in Studio A for this conversation is Midday contributor Klaus Philipson. Klaus is an architect and urban designer who's been on our show several times. He is president of Arc Plan, Inc., and he blogs at arcplanbaltimore.blogspot. Welcome back to Midday, Klaus. Nice to have you on the show again.
Glad to be back.
And here today, for the first time, we welcome D. Watkins to the show. D. Watkins is a writer, an author, and a teacher. He grew up in East Baltimore, dealing crack cocaine and watching his friends and family's lives cut short. After graduating from Dunbar, he pursued his interest in writing, earning his master's in creative writing from the University of Baltimore and a master's in education from Johns Hopkins. His memoir, Cook Up, will be published by Grand Central Publishing next year. So, D. Watkins, we want to welcome you to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And we invited you in because of this piece found very provocative, published last month in Salon. You contribute to Salon. This was titled Black History for Another Starbucks Against the New Baltimore. Quote, my city is gone. My history depleted, ruined, and undocumented. I don't know this new Baltimore. It's alien to me. Baltimore is Brooklyn and D.C. now. No, Baltimore is Chicago or New Orleans or any place where yuppie interests make black neighborhoods shrink like washed sweaters, a place where black history is bulldozed and replaced with Starbucks, Chipotles, and dog parks. So what prompted you to write that?
I want to talk about the title real quick. I didn't pick the title.
You picked the headline?
I never picked the headline or the tagline, and at no point did I ever say that was a, a Starbucks put up in a black neighborhood, you know, that somebody lost their house for us. I didn't say that. I say that in that paragraph. I'm boxing in Brooklyn, D.C., Chicago, and New Orleans together. So a lot of people would misunderstand that. But I wrote it because
I took it metaphorically for the record, okay? So anyway.
Yeah, some people took it literal, and it was, you know, it wasn't meant to be taken like that. But, no, you know, a lot of these essays come from just my own personal experiences. A lot of people think that, a lot of people who read the essay, they kind of took it as if I was against development and diversity, and that's not the case. I'm all about development, and I'm all about diversity, and this isn't the first essay I've written. I don't just contribute to Salon. I'm a columnist for them, and I write about all types of topics. I also write for the city paper, too. My thing is, I don't like how opportunity seems exclusive, and that's one of the things that I wanted to touch on and talk about.
Well, talk about it, because a lot of people, they look at Baltimore redevelopment, and they see they don't see enough jobs coming out of it for people who really need jobs, where the unemployment is highest. Is that partly what you mean?
That's exactly what I mean. Another thing too that I want to touch on, before we get a little more deep into this conversation, is that people don't understand the value of social networks. Like, they'll say really horrible and egregious things about housing projects. They'll talk about Lafayette. They'll talk about Somerset. They'll talk about Chapel Hill. But just because you don't own those properties, it doesn't mean that you don't have a history. It doesn't mean that your family doesn't matter. It doesn't mean that you don't need your neighbor from 1A to help you out when you're a little short on cash. It doesn't mean that your uncle is not the guy that's going to get little Johnny, who's been getting in trouble, a job. Like, these things matter. Like, these social networks and these relationships matter. So a lot of times when gentrification comes through, it destroys social networks and relationships that have been built and constructed for generations are just depleted and gone. I mean, we know public transportation isn't the best for Baltimore. I went to an East Baltimore reunion last year and just sat back in awe at people who didn't see each other for, like 10 or 15 years just because their neighborhoods were ripped apart. So I wanted to talk about that as well.
Okay. I'm going to go to Klaus now. Before I do, you made a reference to Lafayette Courts, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Lafayette, the projects, and that were taken down, like a lot of other those high-rise projects. And I'm glad you just said what you said, because a lot of people don't think about that. They think, well, it's gone, good riddance to the projects. But the people who lived there became a diaspora. Who knows where they are now? Some live near where those projects were, but many went elsewhere.
And the power of how powerful are social networks and having relationships with people. I did a couple of speaking events with Carl Alexander, the author of The Long Shadow, and his book documents 35 years, and he's come up with things like, as a black person with some college, you have less of a chance of getting a job than a white person with some jail. And the only thing that can make the difference is that social network. So if we destroy these social networks, we're creating more poverty and less opportunity.
Klaus, we'll go to you. First of all, we get to talk about the G word a little bit with you, and then we'll go back to D on the G word. I remember, we've always say the G word sometimes. Well, we don't like to talk about gentrification because it's such a fraught word, fraught with so many things. And when we talk about redeveloping neighborhoods and new populations, when you bring that up, you raise all sorts of issues, and mostly of the negative nature.
Yeah, the gentrification word isn't too helpful, particularly not in Baltimore, because the framework is, as described, there is no question that the disparities between the rich and the poor neighborhoods are awful. So the health expectations or the job expectations, the incomes, the home ownership levels, the car ownership levels, whatever indicator you take, is so hugely different between Sandtown and Roland Park, communities that are only a few miles apart, that you think you are like traveling thousands of miles. So cities that have those conditions, and unfortunately, Diane Rehm just talked about this morning, that the income disparities in the country nationwide are the highest in America compared to all other industrialized nations. So Baltimore is not special in that. But as long as cities are like that, it's a very explosive situation and a very not good. So nobody can say a city is really good as long as that is the case. And so with that as the background, gentrification is a very explosive topic. The other thing is, though, we need to distinguish between gentrification and urban renewal. So when we talk about Lafayette Courts, for example, I was called in many years ago by the Housing Commissioner with the Urban Design Committee of AIA to see how this could be redeveloped. And the tenants of Lafayette Courts, the then tenants of the original development, were invited as well, because some of them were supposed to come back and did come back. And so those are urban renewal efforts, and they were done across the country. In Chicago, Gabrini Green was demolished. And the insight that the social fabric is a huge important element, and that just moving to opportunity, as it was called then, and dispersing poverty, as Baltimore did under the ACLU consent decree, that destroys fabric. So it's much more complicated than just taking these projects down. So no question about that.
When you use the word gentrification, D, or when you hear it, what do you think of it? Pretty much what I said at the outset of the show. Is that what you go with?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. And I also think that, you know, when I think of the term, I just think of new opportunities that old residents don't qualify for or can't afford. So, you know, again, I'm all about new development, especially if it's going to bring jobs. But, you know, when I think about that term, you know, and I don't know everything about, I don't know all of the stats. I don't know what happened in every neighborhood. I'm not like a person who studies these things. This is not like my line of work. But what I do know is, you know, I deal with people and personal stories of personal people. So when I think about gentrification, I think about Durham Street, and I think about an older woman I knew, an elderly woman who lived at 1024 Durham. And I know that her biggest honor was she bought that house, and her husband fought in the war and he died, and she buried him, you know, that was their house. And she had two sons. One went to college and moved to Atlanta. One went to prison. But the one who went to college, that house was a resource, and they helped him to get through college because he had a house. The one who used to get in trouble all the time, he, you know, they bailed him out of jail. They had that was her life, on top of the fact that she went to church on Caroline Street. She went to the little shopping market, the little center, Church Square. She went to that shopping market in Church Square. She went to the cleaners. Everything that she needed was in that neighborhood. It was walking distance. And when they came through and knocked that block down, her whole history, her family, the people she knows, the people who she needs to rely on when she, you know, if she was going through a tough time, is gone. And, you know, I remember, because back when I first tried to get out the street, I wanted to, you know, try my hand in real estate. And I remember that the meetings that Hopkins, people who represented Johns Hopkins, had with people who were homeowners in their community. And I'm talking like Rutland Avenue, Eager Street, like all of these things that was just taken down. And I remember them telling those residents that they would have an opportunity to move back, knowing that wasn't the case, and it's not.
In the case that you cite, the woman who lived on North Durham Street, was there a lot of vacancy in that block? Is that why it was torn down?
It was some vacancies on that block.
So she was a holdout. She was a holdout then.
But right? I can't really call it a holdout, because they came through and they basically made offers to every homeowner in that neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So you know, and it wasn't the best neighborhood in the world, but at the same time, you know, if you want to fix a neighborhood, you don't fix neighborhoods by just displacing people and knocking them down. You fix neighborhoods by finding out ways to handle education disparities and healthcare disparities and things like that. Like we need to handle bigger issues instead of just like sending people to Harford County and all the way up Bel Air Road and to somewhere else. Like you're not fixing problems, right? You're displacing them.
What is maybe still important to distinguish between gentrification and urban renewal, because what we're talking about now is the EBDI area behind Hopkins, which is, again, urban renewal. And I worked with the already mentioned Urban Design Committee with then Paula Branch, the councilwoman for the area, to establish principles on how this big idea of biotech and community renewal could be done so that not everybody would be displaced, not everything would be demolished. And that all didn't happen that way. But it is not gentrification in my book, or not what normally is defined as gentrification. Gentrification is when developers come in, because there's a higher value to be had with the stuff that's already on the ground. And that was not the case, and still not the case at EBDI. They would be glad at this point, when so much was demolished, if the developers would actually come in and build stuff, because there's still all this vacant land, because the developers are not eager to come in. So I turned this a bit on its head when I read the Salon.com article from Mr. Watkins and said, well, you know, the problem really is that there is no investment in the African-American communities, in the disinvested, in the poor communities in Baltimore. And I have worked with those communities around the Red Line, for example, around the stations in Rosemont or Harlem Park or West Baltimore, Edmondson Village. And all of those communities, what they want is better services. They would like a coffee shop if they could find one. And they would like dry cleaners. And they would like to have everything that everybody else wants, safe schools, safe streets. And so the problem is this development and those assets are not coming to those communities. They all happen in a very limited area that you described earlier, which a lot of people now call the White L.
The White L, which would be the waterfront, and then north-south up through the central corridor of the city. Yeah. I got a little story for you on gentrification when we get back that involves a woman that I knew on the east side. Dee Watkins is with us from Salon.com. He writes also for the city paper. Thank you for mentioning that. I forgot to mention that.
Yeah, I've been there this week.
good. And Klaus Phillipson is with us as we talk about the G word, gentrification. Is it in Baltimore? Do you see it in Baltimore? If so, where? And if so, do you think that's a problem? 410-662-8780. And welcome back to Midday. Gentrification, do you know it when you see it? This is a Facebook posting from Timothy, who says, this city, meaning Baltimore, needs more middle-income and upper-income residents of any race, creed, or sex. The city has a disproportionate share of the lower-income population and people with various social support needs. Baltimore's disproportionate share of social issues relative to the metro counties is part of the reason the budget is strained, taxes and fees are higher than the surrounding counties, and investments in maintenance and capital repairs are so lacking. So Timothy doesn't really say maybe what he wants to say here, which is don't badmouth gentrification because the city needs taxpaying middle-income, upper-income people.
No, we definitely need taxpaying people, and we definitely need we all need to be collectively working together to create opportunities for the people, for the great people of this city. That's what we need to do. Anyone with power, anyone with influence, anyone who has the ability to help a person find a job or to help people. You know, people don't want to be criminals, and people don't want to be poor, especially not in America. Nobody wants to be a poor criminal. It's just a lot of people are victims of circumstance, and we don't really do enough to address those issues in a real way. And I think that other resistance that you know I was met with when I actually wrote this article came from a large segment of people who just don't care about poor people or black people or minorities in general in the city. They just don't care. Like, they don't care. And that mentality is out there. You can see with the Freddie Gray story. You know, you could just beat a black person to death and, okay, well, everybody wait. Let's wait 8 months. Let's take 8 months to construct the police report, right? Let's figure out what we want to say. You know, anytime, you know, you can treat a human like that, you don't see a human. They beat him like he wasn't even a human, like he was some type of animal that wasn't a dog.
So in the reaction to your piece in Salon, for some people, it was, well, we don't need poor people here. What are you talking about? Poor people. We need people who are going to pay taxes and have more.
Yeah,
greater
your story.
Income.
Your story doesn't matter. You don't matter if you don't have a certain amount of money or a certain income. You don't matter if you're black and you're robbing Peter to pay Paul to survive. Your perspective isn't wanted in this conversation. So, you know, be displaced and you should be happy with it. Like, my thing is this: if you have a story about urban renewal or gentrification that is transformative and that helped you out and that, you know, and you were able to build a great life for yourself, then that's cool. I'm all with that. But all I'm saying is that saying yes to something and saying no to something else, somebody's winning and somebody's losing. No, there hasn't been many situations where everybody won. And I'm saying that, you know, I'm sorry. I'm saying that I have a right to miss my neighborhood. I have a right to talk about where I grew up at. I have a right to miss my friends. I have a right to love my community. There's nothing wrong with that. If you love the new community, you can write about it. If you love the changes, you can be happy about it. I'm not telling you what to be happy about, but you can't tell me that I'm wrong for, you know, I got weird reactions like, oh, well, you know, there's some white people that feel worse. Okay, cool. They can feel bad. That's their right. But I still can miss my community.
Klaus.
Well, sure. This is the emotional side of it, and nostalgia is part of it. There people have a history, and they, of course, are wedded to their history. That's not the question, though. I mean, on a practical level, when we are discussing on how we move forward and how we change the communities, this what sounds like there are so many people that just don't care. I don't want to judge that. Maybe there are too many people that don't care, but a lot of it comes from not knowing. The way how we have divided our city, it is so that most more affluent people have never set foot in one of the poor neighborhoods, so let alone that they know people there and know their stories. So that is all true, and it's not going to be changed by cementing the status quo. And so when we talked in West Baltimore about what aspirations the communities have, it was becoming very clear very soon that there's so much abandonment and so much extra space and so many vacant buildings that there's lots of opportunity to bring additional people in without displacing anybody. Now, renter displacement is a problem because you can give homesteading credits to homeowners, but you can't easily freeze rents. But there are methods too. You can create co-ops. You can do all kinds of things. And those we discussed, and some of those were also discussed in Washington, D.C. And at some point, they don't. They may not be effective anymore. But at this point, we're still wondering on how we get investment into West Baltimore, the Mark Twain Station area, where there's nothing. And the community is dying to have something. They are dying also because and this is not just a matter of race, anybody who has the means to move out there pretty much has done so already. That's why there is so much vacant. And in that state, you don't have the services and you don't have power. You don't have a voice at City Hall. And so, therefore, Tim's comment there about we need more middle-class people is correct. And given the demographics and given the fact that the black middle class was the last middle class that moved out, it's unlikely that they are the first middle class that will move back. So the people that come in will look different than the ones that are on the ground. I think there's just no way around it.
I'm going to give the phone number to our listeners to join our conversation with Klaus Philipson and Dee Watkins, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. I just wanted to mention one thing here. It seems to me that when the projects went down, a couple of the projects were destroyed, demolished, that what replaced them was new housing that was inclusive of multiple levels of income. And that if not the government doing that, it wouldn't have happened otherwise. That private developers do not have much motivation or incentive. There is incentive that the government provides, but not much motivation to provide affordable housing. So, Dee, if you take down Lafayette Courts and you displace a whole bunch of people for 2 or 3 years while you're knocking that down and redeveloping, maybe some of those people can come back and actually live in those areas, right? Because the housing is intended for multiple levels of income as people move along. And we saw that on the east side, too, over near Little Italy and when Flag House went down. So if not for the government manipulating and managing that, you wouldn't have seen it. I just wanted to throw that in there, that one of the answers to this, it seems to me, is more affordable housing and more inclusive housing in that regard. We're going to take a couple of calls here. Christine in Baltimore, you're on the Midday Show. Welcome.
Hi. Yeah, thank you. And I love your article, Dee Watkins.
Thank you.
I guess I wanted to touch on, you guys touched on a lot of things, but I think a main one that just came up was that, like, what you were saying, you think that, like, if the city has interest in it, then people can come back. But that's just a lie. Like, if you look at places where they did redevelop, you don't see individuals of that community ever coming back. I mean, look at Little Italy now. Like, it's not diverse per se, you know. And then I did some work in Middle East Baltimore and just talking to neighbors there. And a lot of them, I would tell, you know, ask them what's going on with your community. And there was a woman who said that she needed to have two jobs to pay her BG&E bill alone. And she believed that a lot of it was driven by, you know, the proximity to Hopkins. And she said a lot of her neighbors, you know, can't live there anymore because those BG&E bills are so high. Not to mention rent is also high because of the proximity to Hopkins, you know. And so she's seen her community change so much. And the vacants are sort of driven by that proximity and that relationship, which is not really a relationship, but more of like it seems like a co-op, you know, because Hopkins now can come in and develop the area and make it, you know, so that their doctors and their nurses and their staff who are not members of that community can come back and, you know, live there and thrive. And everybody who was from there and who had that connection there is no longer, you know, going to be able to come back there and, you know,
Christine, thank you. I think Klaus was referring to this earlier. You think that's an accurate description of what's going on over there?
Well, in part, EBDI is certainly not a planning model for anything. It was very aspirational and wanted to bring back one-third low-income tenants and one-third market-rate tenants and one-third homeowners and first-time homeowners as well as others. The BGE bill is not a function of where you are located, but what you are consumed. So that's probably not a good example. The rents should be protected in certain areas there. But the rebuilding has not worked very well. They should have never, never, never destroyed everything in the phase one, demolished every single house. They gave fairly, well, large relocation funds out, but it's true, very few people came back. And I worked with some people that wanted to stay in the community, and we negotiated that they would get the relocation funds to stay in place and remodel their houses to modern standards. But that was a very, very small scale. So
why didn't they want to come back?
Well, you know, this is not that easy to, first off, they need to build new stuff before you can come back. Second, once you moved out and you did all that hassle, then you're staying somewhere else. You created a new network. You're not just a little ping pong ball that can just move around the city.
So what would have been a better model for that? What can you say and for all today on Midday? what would have been a better plan for that, the people who live there?
In my book, The more incremental plans are always much better. The plans that wholesale knock everything down seem to be never working right. And to keep the social infrastructure, the social capital, the networks in place of those communities that have stuck it out over all the decades, and then build additional and new things in and around the community, I think is a much better way to go.
Dee?
Yeah, I agree.
That's what you were talking about before, about the lady on North Durham Street, right?
Yeah, like, you know, people want, you know, you're right. People, they want new businesses. They want nice places to live. They want to stay.
They want their church?
Yeah, they want their church. They want their neighborhoods. It's always the same old story. So even if, you know, if we're not going to call it gentrification, if we're going to call it urban renewal, you know, either way, there's just a trend of poor people being displaced. And, you know, I think collectively, you know, as a person who represents many of these communities, we're responsible for doing something about it and trying to change it. I don't think, you know, I have all of the answers, but I know my mission is literacy and communication. And, you know, that plays a major part. You know, if you can read and have complex thoughts and think and understand how to talk to these developers and these people, or even how to navigate through society at a high level, then you know, then we could bring about real change. And then somebody else might have a different mission that will help too, but we all got to figure out what we're good at and just try to like maximize that potential.
But if we go back to the drivers of gentrification for a second and go away from urban renewal, which is like sort of a paradigm of the last century in some ways, what the good news to me, as somebody who selected Baltimore as a choice home, I could live anywhere in the country, but I picked Baltimore. So the good news to me is that there are more people now that pick Baltimore as the region where to live, and that we have a lot of young people coming in, and that Baltimore has a certain vibe that people say, well, this is not just a place where everything is lost. I mean, there was Ruskin writing a book at the turn of the century where he said, we are beyond the point of no return, you know, beyond help. And that's not the case anymore. And there are investors coming in, and there are people coming in, and there are stores coming in, there are businesses coming in. I think all of that is good news, because without that, we would be really on a dying vine, and nobody would be helped with that.
Krauss had an excellent essay as well that we posted on my Facebook page, along with Dee Watkins' piece for Salon on Baltimore, where you talk about authenticity. Authenticity is another word. It's the A word. So we go from gentrification to the A word. We hear a lot about this. Like, people are moving to cities, young people especially, they like city life, and they come here for the authenticity, meaning traditional neighborhoods that have been around for a while, the real mm-hmm. thing, people who are settled and stable, and an identity, a character, all those words get thrown into it. And so, Klaus, you say in the piece, you know, that the millennials in particular, 18 to 35 years old or so, either come here for the authenticity or their influx drives it out. It's an interesting...
It's like my generation when they all went to the suburbs. They came there, they went to the suburbs for the nature and for the quiet and the peace and the remoteness and the rapids and whatever, the runs. And then when everybody did that, of course, they drove all of that out. And then with that, there was no authenticity whatsoever. So this generation, my generation, the baby boomers that really drove all the trends in the country and other countries for a long time and the entire culture, they created a culture of predictiveness. You know, you go to a McDonald's, you know exactly what you get. You have all the hotels look exactly what the brand recommends and or promises, and so on and so forth. And the younger generation, our kids now, they are the ones who reverse this. They are really tired of this. It's really, there's nothing happening. And so that's how the cities all of a sudden have an influx again, because cities, by virtue of being historic and have been around for decades, they have layers and layers of stuff, and they have all kinds of diversity. They are not all totally income stratified, you know, not in every street, even though we have the neighborhood divisions.
Gee, what do you think of that word, authenticity in city life?
I think that Baltimore has a rich Black history. One time it was the place that had more free Blacks in America than any other city in our country. And I think that history helped shape this city in a strong way. And if we lose that history, if we don't document these stories, if we move these people out, then Baltimore's going to be a different place. I don't know what it's going to look like, but it's not going to be the same. It's not going to be authentic Baltimore.
Author and writer Dee Watkins, a Baltimore native, guest in this hour of Midday with Klaus Philipson, Baltimore architect. We'll take another break here, come back, and open the phone lines again. 410-662-8780. Talking about the G word, gentrification, A word, authenticity in this hour of the show about city life. A short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here with Dee Watkins and Klaus Philipson. 410-662-8780 is the number. We're going to go to the phone lines to take some more calls in just a second. Here's an email from Carol with a comment about the EBDI, East Baltimore Development Incorporated project around the Hopkins campus in East Baltimore. When the demolition of neighborhoods around Hopkins was just starting, an article in The Sun quoted a proponent as saying that there was nothing there before. Many of us in Build, Baltimoreans United in Leadership Development, many of us in Build had been meeting and working with the families for years through their congregations and schools. The residents had long histories in the neighborhood, and yet a person could get away with saying that there was nothing there before. Interesting. Thank you very much. I've heard people say such things about lots of neighborhoods. Usually that's across the racial fault line, that comment right there. Tonya in D.C. giving us a ring on Midday. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, thanks for calling.
This is my first time calling in, and I'm actually making a choice to leave Washington, D.C. as an African-American female to move to Baltimore. So I'm actually a high-wage earner, not originally from this area, originally from Detroit. I do civil engineering and urban planning for the government, and I definitely want to be one of the blacks in the 21st century to take a neighborhood like Reservoir Hills, which is where I plan to purchase, and bring the African-American culture back in a new and different way. We should all ultimately be able to live together harmoniously in one neighborhood, but people need to see more folks that look like me, that are educated and are willing to take a neighborhood that needs a bit of a facelift and just bring it back. And Baltimore is my absolute choice.
I like what I'm hearing here, Tonya. You're making a choice for a very good reason, it sounds like to me. You've thought about this a lot.
I have, and I think being from Detroit, Michigan, and watching that particular city decline, you know, one of the things I've noticed just in my professional life, dealing with engineering and planning for building transit projects, is that you need to have that particular nucleus to start bringing back economic development. You know, they say that if you build it, they will come. And in some cases, that's not always the case. You need to look at a neighborhood and see if it's fertile enough where people would come even without the transit investment. And I think, just based on my professional experience being from Detroit, that Baltimore is particularly ready. And I actually think that Reservoir Hills is probably going to be the very next area. The difference between my personality and where I'm coming from is that I don't want gentrification to exclude people. I want to be able to buy in that neighborhood, take a bank-owned home, you know, restore it to the studs. But I want to go into the community so that whites, blacks, and others can see that, you know, this is what my parents invested in, so that you can continue generationally what our family started in Detroit. I'm just finishing it in Baltimore.
In Baltimore, right?
Right,
Tonya,
right.
I'm glad you called the show. Dee and Klaus, any comment about Tonya's idea here?
No, I think it's important, and I think we need that. And a lot of times, you know, if you write an article like the one that I've written and you talk about race or you talk about class, you know, people always jump to the conclusion by saying or acting like you're picking a side, like this is the black side, this is the white side. No, we need to have a diverse place. And I said it before, I'll say it again. Opportunity, you know, should be as diverse as the places we want to live in. You know, diversity isn't about, it's not about excluding people. It's about we should be able to include everyone.
Yeah, welcome, Tonya, to Baltimore. You're absolutely right. We need a lot more of you and everywhere, and it shouldn't be about race. It shouldn't be solely about income. It should be just about people coming here of all walks of life. And the problem, though, is that in African-American neighborhoods where it's 90 or 100% African-American, we don't find enough people coming in and back into these communities, and that has held Baltimore back. Now DC has shown that can change also, but in Baltimore there is so far no African American community that has really turned around.
Let's take another call. Frank in Aberdeen, welcome to the show. Hi.
Yes, sir. My observation is I think it would only take one home on a semi-stable block. You put in that one home and then watch the neighborhood blossom. I don't know. Is that called urban homesteading?
Let's see. On homesteading, Klaus, we go back to the 70s and 80s. I mentioned the dollar houses here in Federal Hill and elsewhere.
Yeah, everybody
in the city.
Wants to.
It's a great program once upon a time.
Everybody wants it back.
Yeah, I would like a dollar house today.
But, you know, first off, we don't have the block grants and all the federal money anymore. And second, you know, this was not as equal opportunity as it sounded, because you paid only a dollar, but you needed to have a bank behind you.
Yep.
And you needed to make a commitment to fix it up in a certain time. one house in a block is not enough. We have tried that. I have worked in Sandtown with Build and with Enterprise, and if you don't fix a whole block, it's not very successful, because if you live in the fixed-up house and right next to you it's vacant and it rains through the roof and there are rats and there are vagrants and there's all kinds of stuff going on, you are not going to be a happy camper.
Do you think in that regard, it's a quick question, that the city is making progress with vacants to value in that regard, the one you just described?
Progress, yes. It's just,
I mean, they're not just doing one house at a time. They're doing,
we all have learned a lot. Yeah. In doing this for decades and decades. This isn't something that discussion, you know, when did gentrification start? I don't know. Was it when Charles Center was done, the Inner Harbor was done, the dollar houses were done, the freeways were built?
And well, I'm glad you mentioned the freeways. Because when you told your story, Dee, about North Durham Street, I was thinking of a story near Canton. You look at Canton today, and it's, you know, it is what it is today, right? But for a long time there, when the expressway was going to go through there, they tore down a whole bunch of houses along Boston Street. Those were vacant lots down there. And I remember speaking to an elderly woman who she was going to she wanted to leave her house. Someone offered her a good price. And I forget what street she was on. Maybe it was Dillon Street. Anyway, you know, somebody offered a good price. So her kids who lived in the suburbs in Harford County weren't interested in that area. And I bet they wish they had held on to the house by now. But anyway, so she left, and that whole block changed eventually within about a 10-year period of time. Stephen in Charles Village, you're on Midday next. Hi.
Yes, I'm calling in regards to the gentrification word. I first heard that word from the movie Boys in the Hood. It's the first time I ever became aware of that word.
Me too.
And now it seems to be, I seem to be a product of that in a particular block that I live in, which is in Charles Village. It seems to be a disparity in the type of people that are replacing, that are coming in and getting the new homes in comparison to the people who were previously here. Now, I live in a house that's recently just been condemned. And I was wondering, since I am still a legal tenant here, my rent is in escrow, I was wondering, once a buyer decides to take this house, what kind of position does that put me in terms of being displaced? Because I really don't want to be displaced. But I was wondering, does that put me in a compromising position?
Klaus, can you help with that?
Well, the rental protection laws generally in the United States are, for example, not nearly as good as they are, say, where I grew up in Germany. In this case, if a landlord buys something and is a new landlord coming in, or even if he just changes his mind, once the rental contract is out, you can displace any renter anytime. So that's why I said earlier, rental protection is a problem, and that there need to be additional measures taken to protect renters.
So he doesn't actually, Stephen, he's in a bit of a precarious situation there.
Well, and with the condemned home and all that.
In Charles Village.
There are additional problems, yes. Yeah.
This is an interesting email from Chris. He says, since I moved here 10 years ago from the county, I can't help feel that the contract, or at least the sales pitch for the city, has changed. Baltimore was a warts and all city, in quotes, not too long ago. You moved here with the understanding, if not acceptance, of a number of key factors, that the city was majority black, that the housing stock was older, that crime would be a fact of life. You moved in to embrace the realness, the weirdness, and the charm. Today, it seems like the sales pitch for the city is more Manhattan, but cheaper. Too many residents seem completely taken aback by the city when they settle here and act conspicuously uncomfortable. I too frequently read or hear some variant of walk two blocks in any direction and it's like you're in a war zone. What's sad is such comments are often directed toward neighborhoods like Hamden, Mount Vernon, or Canton. Anyway, thank you very much for that. But that's interesting about the sales pitch that you hear about Baltimore, what realtors, anybody says about Baltimore these days. This is different than it was just a few years ago, really.
It goes back to the whole idea of authenticity, you know, like, and you know, cities change or cities evolve. So, you know, with my position, or you know, the role I would like to take on is as a person who helps contribute to the residents who choose to stay and who love Baltimore and who want to stay. I want to help and I want to do what I can do as far as my mission is concerned.
James is calling from Middle East and has a different view of our characterizations about what happened over there and is happening. James, welcome.
Hi, Mr. Roderick. It's James, Middle East, long-time listener. Enjoy your show.
Thank you.
And I wanted to provide a counterpoint to some of the callers and the guests about Middle East. I think what Hopkins is doing is a good thing in Middle East. Prior to their investment in the community, in the area, there was hardly any investment up here. It was very blooded, had some of the worst crime in the city. And for decades prior to before Hopkins started developing up here, everybody within and without the community was like complaining about how there was no investment in the community. Now I'm a homeowner and I'm an urban pioneer. I've been in the neighborhood for about 10 years and I've seen dramatic improvements in the neighborhood. And we need more of it, not less of it. So that's pretty much my point.
Okay.
I don't know.
All right.
If you just want to respond to that or not, but
you know, it's been sort of piecemeal, hasn't it? I mean, the recession hit. The recession didn't help. Let's say that. But Klaus.
Well, we can only hope moving forward that we do get more development there because vacant land is not what anybody wanted, and there are good plans. There's a park in the middle, and if they're moving forward and they're doing with the one-third that was envisioned, I hope that this will eventually have success. It takes a long time.
I think, I think the caller might have missed one of the things that I was saying. I think everyone's about new development. Everyone's about lowering crime. These are things that we all care about. We're talking about why these crimes occur. We're talking about why these neighborhoods were the way they were and why they are the way they are. You know, it's about opportunity. You know, if more opportunity was available to more people, then, you know, the whole city would be a better place.
But that's what I'm thinking, that with the influx of young creative talent that we have, we'll get new ideas, we'll learn, and we will also become a different place in a good way. It's not everything was so wonderful in the past that if we would just not change, we would be so much better off. It's the opposite, and I'm very hopeful about where we are going and that we are going and that we are moving. And
new people, new ideas, right. Entrepreneurs, innovation, new companies, stay in the city, live in the city, invest in the city, create jobs here, workplaces here. And this is why we always end up with the
and
E
build
word.
Transit.
And build transit. But that's the T word. I go to the E word, education, all the time. We always come back to education, education. Have a skilled, educated workforce that can come, go away to college, come back and live here, and work in these new jobs that will be created in this new economy. I mean, that's sort of my vision of it. So we're going to end the hour with my vision. I hope you don't mind. D. Watkins, you can read his essay that started this conversation. Find it on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. You have a piece in the City Paper this week. What's it about?
It's about.
I saw the headline. Did you write the headline?
Did I write the headline?
It had to do with lattes and soy lattes.
Yeah,
and what?
I'm starting a column with the City Paper called Newports and Soy Lattes. So, you know, I'm telling personal stories and funny stories.
That's what your column's called?
Yeah.
Oh, it's the name of the column.
The column in the City Paper. Yeah, I'm starting a column with the City Paper, Newports and Soy Lattes.
Okay. I like the title.
Yeah, it's all fun.
D. Watkins.
It's about drug laws.
Oh, it's about drug laws?
Yeah.
Thank you for being here, D. It's nice to meet you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Good luck to you. Klaus Philipson, make sure you read his essay on authenticity and gentrification, too. Also, find it on my Facebook page. Thank you, Klaus.
Thank you.
Thank you, D. And thank you, everybody. We'll see you again soon.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Alexis Kuhn, Aaron Morenzi, and Mary Troutman. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.